Hey, Jenna here from the show Pacific Underground, the radio show that explores the Asian and Pacific Islander experience in America. We're looking for producers and writers to join our team. So we're inviting those who identify as Asian or Pacific Islander to attend a Pacific Underground information meeting on Wednesday, April 26th at 7 p.m. at KBOO Radio, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue at Burnside. More information can be found at www.pacificunderground.org or on our Facebook at PAC Underground.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Pete Seeger Tribute and Sing-Along happening Sunday, April 30th at 6:30 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. At this celebration of Pete Seeger's birthday, his life and his legacy will be honored. This event features a concert and videos, as well as a sing-along. Again, that's the Pete Seeger Tribute and Sing-Along, Sunday, April 30th at 6:30 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on, hold on, hold on, hold on. Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on, hold on.
This is KBOO Portland.
Welcome to Poetry and Everything, and this is special because this is our April show, and April is Poetry Month in the United States of America. So we're having poetry people on the poetry show during Poetry Month for this show. I'm Judith Arcana, your host. Each month we have guests who are Portland poets, nearby poets, and that's the situation tonight, or faraway poets for that matter, pairs of poets, groups of poets, sometimes even folks who are not poets, although frankly that won't happen often. Everybody reading and talking about poetry and everything. We almost always open with me reading one of my own poems. Then the guests and I will read poems by other folks, not us, and then we'll get into their work. So I'm going to read, and I chose this, I'm going to read one of mine, and I chose this one because I know that these guests, Tony and Chris, like this poem. So I brought it. It's called Roll Over Beethoven from, of course, the now late, great Chuck Berry's work, his canon, if I may say so. And I've begun it with an epigraph from Cyndi Lauper, who is an interesting pair with Chuck Berry. She said, "This is rock and roll. We should not be conservative, and we should not be safe." Cyndi Lauper. Okay. What if I set up a soundtrack of my life, like a movie? Choosing a song, a theme for every crucial scene, notable speech, realization. For the night I knew I could leave my marriage, is Night on Bald Mountain too obvious? For cliches of bad faith adult behavior, example, affair with married father of young children. Maybe something strident from Carmen? Or should it all be doo-wop, R&B? Rockabilly, because every song I heard in high school lives inside my body, inside maybe every cell. 55, 56, transistor radios, you could carry the music, you could take it to the beach. Even now, when memory bites us all, every note, every word is instantly available. Total recall shooting through me like adrenaline. Bo Diddley, Fats Domino, Etta James, Elvis, and Brenda Lee, who was younger than me. I don't have those clothes anymore, but if I did, I'd put them on and dance all night in Mickey's basement. So, tonight's guests, to whom I dedicate that poem, are Christopher Luna and Tony Partington. Chris and Tony co-host Ghost Town Poetry Open Mic, the series he established in 2004. Together, they founded Printed Matter Vancouver, a small press and editing service. So not only are there two of them working together on those projects, but each of them does notably more than two things, and I'm going to tell you about them. Christopher Luna, a graduate of the Jack Kerouac School of Disembodied Poetics, is Clark County's Poet Laureate and a visual artist, editor, workshop leader, and writing coach. His own books include Brutal Glints of Moonlight, Ghost Town USA, and The Flame is Ours, The Letters of Stan Brakhage and Michael McClure, 1961 to 1978. And some recent publications include Washington 129, Bombay Gin, Unshod Quills, It's Animal But Merciful, Karan Review, and Soundings Review. As Vancouver's Poet Laureate, Chris created a Poets in the Schools program and Poetry Moves, which places poems by local writers on C-Tran buses. Now, Tony Partington, is a poet, editor, publisher, visual artist, and writing coach in Vancouver, Washington. She has a BA in social work and an MA in humanities. She's the author of two books of poetry, Jesus is a Gas from 2009 and Wind Wing from 2010. Her poetry appears in many journals, including the Cascade Journal, Voice Catcher, OutwardLink.net, and Perceptions. As a visual artist, Tony uses paint, pastels, found images and objects to create collaged art, and enjoys collaborating, especially when art and poetry find a common voice. Her work's been shown at Angst Gallery. I want to pronounce that the German way, Angst Gallery, North Bank Gallery, Culture Control, and L. Allen Arts here in Portland. Welcome, Chris and Tony.
Hi.
Thank you. Hi.
Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for inviting us.
Oh, literally my pleasure. or all of us. Okay, we can all have pleasure. So they've come over the river from Vancouver to join us tonight, and we are now going to read our choices of poems by other poets. So whichever one of you wants to go first, take it.
Okay, I brought a poem by Bob Kaufman. And the reason that I chose this poem is because it's Bob Kaufman's birthday today.
Ah.
Bob Kaufman is one of the San Francisco poets who gets a little bit less attention than the Beats because he was African-American. And when I was at the Kerouac School, I spent a week with the poet David Henderson, who prepared a long radio documentary about Bob Kaufman. And I feel very fortunate that I had that experience of hanging out with David and learning about Bob Kaufman. And I just like his stuff a lot. So here's Bob Kaufman. The poem is called When We Hear the Eye Open. When we hear the eye open there in that place, there a whisper is a scream. Breathing there in that place, a breath is the birth of sound. We shall see our reflections on the gigantic thighs of a giant. There in that place, my head is a bony guitar. Strung with tongues, plucked by fingers and nails. The giant is only his legs. The rest of him will be gone far on, and blinking cities will fly from his knees. And in a future, in that place there, I was a nut in a chocolate bar, and I melted in a soft hand, and we sang a Luna tune. The ear hears fear, the eye lies, the mind dies, the teeth curl, and runic stone alone weeps at the death of sleep. Colder than a frozen nun, chilly accusations point. Naked river, screamer on lonely poet corners. Yes, and bugs with lights, another crime of mine. How else walk against these black winds of mind death? Blowing down these lonely streets, they have found a way to disturb the moon. The sun burns at love's two ends on the eternal launching pad. Bob Kaufman.
Thank you. Thank you. All right.
All right.
And you, lady.
Yes. I'm going to read a poem by Dorianne Locks. And the reason I'm reading it is that I started writing when I was 10 and then wrote for many years. But when I started sort of on my career path, I got focused on doing career. And many people can relate to that. You get doing that and the writing sort of took a back seat. But in the mid-90s, as I was working at Mount Hood Community College, Dorianne was a featured poet that came to campus, and I took my class, and we went to the theater, and we sat in our seats, and I listened to her read, and she read this poem that I'm going to read, and after hearing this, I thought her style was amazing, and we had a lot in common, and it launched me back into writing on a regular basis.
All right.
The Tooth Fairy by Dorianne Lox. They brushed a quarter with glue and glitter, slipped in on bare feet, and without waking me, painted rows of delicate gold footprints on my sheets with a love so quiet I still can hear it. My mother must have been a beauty then, sitting at the kitchen table with him, a warm breeze lifting her embroidered curtains, waiting for me to fall asleep. It's harder to believe the years that followed, the palms curled into fists, a floor of broken dishes, her chain-smoking through long silences, him punching holes in the walls. I can still remember her print dresses, his checkered taxi, the day I found her in the closet with a paring knife, the night he kicked my sister in the ribs. He lives alone in Oregon now, dying slowly of a rare bone disease, his face stippled gray, his ankles clotted beneath wool socks. She's a nurse on the graveyard shift, comes home mornings and calls me, drinks her dark beer and goes to bed. And I still wonder how they did it, slipped that quarter under my pillow, made those perfect footprints. Whenever I visit her, I ask again. I don't know, she says, rocking, closing her eyes. We were as surprised as you.
Oh, yeah. Both of you, what great choices. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm, thank you.
Okay, and I, my choice for the, what I always call OPW, Other People's Work, is a poem by Susan Stewart, and it was actually sparked by two other poets because last month the guest was Susan Moore, and she read some Susan Stewart poems. Ordinarily, I would not do that because, you know, it was done last month, but I just thought, oh, yeah, that poem. And then, just a few weeks after that, I had a conversation with Tom Hogan, who is one of our poetry folk out in Milwaukee, and he told me an extraordinary personal anecdote that involved great big wings, and I thought, okay, I got to read this poem. So here it is. This is Susan Stewart's poem, Wings. If you could have wings, would you want them? I don't know. I mean, if you could use them to fly, would you want them? Yes, if I could fly. But they would be really big. How big? They might brush against your knees as you walked, or be bigger than some doorways. And what if you couldn't ever take them off? I still would want them. If you couldn't take them off, even if you were going somewhere, or going to bed, or eating at a table, or you wanted to pick someone up, you could never take them off? Yes, I would. I would still want them. Because you could fly? Yes, because of the flying. And if they were heavy, or even if no one else had them, and even if your children and their children didn't have them? Yes, I think so. But you would still have arms and legs and hands, and you could still speak, but you had wings too. You would want the wings too? Yes, I would want the wings too. And when you were walking around, people would stare at you, and they wouldn't necessarily understand that you could fly. I understand. I understand that they wouldn't understand. Or if people thought they meant something, something they didn't really mean, I would know what the wings were for. And if you had them forever, the forever, I mean, that is your life, you would still want them? Yes, I would want them. I would take them. So long as I could fly. that I might fly away, that I might fly away where the ships, that I might fly away where the ships of Pinewood pass between the dark cliffs. Mm. First time I read that poem, I thought, oh, I don't even know what to feel, you know, full body chill, etc. So thanks to Susan Stewart, who is not here in the studio with us, folks. Okay, so thank you both for those wonderful choices. And for those of you who have just tuned in and therefore missed already a lot of good stuff, this is KBOO, Portland Community Radio, and the show is Poetry and Everything. And now, our two guests, Chris and Tony, are going to read to us from their own work, but not at the same time, individually, and succinctly and clearly and musically and lyrically and all those other good things we want when we're reading our poems. So have you decided between you who's up first?
No, we haven't.
Okay,
let's get to pick.
Okay, Tony.
Sure.
I was going to go for alphabetical order, and then I thought, no, don't do that, too ordinary, so I went the other way.
Okay, great. I'm going to start with one that I wrote after we visited Walt Whitman's birthplace on Long Island, and Christopher is from Long Island, and so I wrote this, and it is for him. Mm. The Good Gray Poet. I sing myself. My eyes are burning from the south. Canada geese amid dogwood blossoms, somber men wait as I harbor for good or bad. The creek runs with the pink waste of war, wounds revealed by a revolution of words. Their souls are starbound, every leaf a miracle in the cardinal's mouth. Please braid the rope for our bed. Tie the knots and fill the mattress with the magazines you've finished clipping. You could live right here, learn the ways of the caretaker. I will tend the roses while the boy picks fruit for breakfast. You will write it all down, and more, until the good gray poet visits your dreams, takes your hands, and whispers, "Come, come, let us write, for we are one tonight." Hmm. A Reason for Corn, and I wrote this for John Trudell. John Trudell is following the lines, a mandate for life since the day of the fire. Before his family was murdered by smoke and flame, he stood tall against Vietnam and Alcatraz, Wounded Knee and the BIA. He was warned the day he burned the U.S. flag, and 12 hours later, his home burnt to the ground and claimed those he loved. For now, his loves are embedded in the land. He knows that five bodies in boxes below dirt will surely grow corn. So John Trudell will follow the lines as any poet must, until the day the land swallows him whole and corn grows in perfect rows where he once stood. Perennial New York. The sumac is blooming in central New York, flame red spikes bursting fire beside the thruway. The sumac grow tall along the concrete wall at the house on Little Rock Way, the house I lost after betrayal and his passing. Each year I waited for new blooms, drawn to the edge of the yard, expectant. Why is this memory imprinted, lodged in the so familiar sumac of my youth, where memories live in fern-like stems? Tell me why some harbor poison, while others offer comfort in benign indifference. I am still learning about disloyalty, the way that false trust smacks my jaw, breaks my very spirit. My sumac, why do you command me back in time to reconstruct the girl with golden ringlets, stung by wasps to learn trust. So much water in the Hudson and under the bridge of lost years. Can one really go home at another time, no better, no worse? A time before the taste of profound sadness, when everything on the tongue went sweet except tears. How do we endure all that life asks of us? Humility, cicadas, and too many relatives' noses in everyone's business. Their spats birth a lifetime of grudges, sticky like mud in the Erie Canal when it holds onto bare feet and grief. Oh, Sumac, here you are again. You bring yourself back year after year, yet you cannot bring back the innocence I require to reinvent those long-gone dreams. Screenplay. I can write about anything but you. It's always too early or too late to incarcerate my senses, uncoil thoughts into words drawn from the infinite vat of language. Can I forgive the melodrama before you? I lived around the corner from despair. This time, despair is the invisible man, and you are Bogie, Tracy, or James Dean, and I write about them until I can write about you. Driven by Hope. At one time or another, he had a family, a parent, a brother, phone numbers written in ink on the palm of his hand, thanks strangers for spare change to make the call. Can I come home, Mom? Just for tonight. Someone stole my stuff and I got popped. It's cold out. The family's been here before. It never goes well, because their hope is habit-forming. He looks like hell, smells foul, wants a smoke, coughs the 10-mile markers home and yells, "Coffee!" when he enters the house. Mom's cooked a grilled cheese sandwich, trimmed crust timed perfectly crisp and brown. He slumps on the saved seat. She takes the cup with D-A-V-I-D, David, painted on the side in red block letters, pours it full, adds 4 sugars to half and half. Won't look in her eyes, knows she's been crying. Soon she'll ask when he last slept. He will lie. She will believe anything he says because her hope is habit-forming. Won't eat the sandwich, can't eat anything. His stomach burns all the time. She's made up his bed, offered towels, vitamins. He spends an hour in the bathroom, lets the shower run while he sits on the floor smoking. Imagines how water stings when it touches his body. Goes to his room when the house is quiet. The sheets smell like downy and her hair. She's cried here. Soon she'll peek in, make sure he's in bed, blow a kiss on sweet breath from the doorway. Waits another half hour, moves to the couch, then to the floor. Hasn't been able to sleep on anything soft in years. At 4, he takes his brother's new parka from the closet, pockets the jar of change from the hall table, steals a check from her purse and writes, "I really can't be here. I love you. I'll call." He's out the front door and into the darkness. Mother watches from upstairs, glad tonight that her room faces the street. This is the moment she fears. Could be the last time. She has this morbid thought each time he goes. He crosses the lawn, moves out from beneath the street light, slips behind the neighbor's lilac tree, sees her in the window. This could be the last time. He thinks this morbid thought whenever he leaves. He wonders why hope is habit-forming, wonders what happened to him, wants to hope for something else, so he hopes she'll be able to sleep. He hopes she'll be able to sleep.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. If you have a tiny one, we have maybe a minute, but if you're stuck.
I have a five-line poem.
That's a tiny one.
On the streets of Vancouver right now in a program called Rain Coup, and
cool.
It only shows up when it rains.
I love it already. I haven't even heard it. Okay.
No title for this one. And if you've been to Vancouver, this might be familiar to you. We cross Main Street at twilight as a lazy wind blows north. You smile inside the crosswalk. I watch the birch trees bend to match the curve of your lips.
Okay, mm-hmm. What a good closer.
And I'd like to mention that on April 29th, Tony and the other poets who are part of Rain Coup will be in downtown Vancouver for a crawl where maps will be handed out and the poets will be there to read their poems, and there will be water provided just in case it's not a rainy day.
In case it's not a rainy day.
So I'd like to invite anyone listening to this to come and join us on the 29th and check out all the Rain Coup poets.
Excellent. Thanks for the info. Okay, you're on, Chris. A reading now.
All right. And thank you. Sigil Against the Spirit Death of the Psychonaut. Catholic school sense memory, the constant purgatory of fear. Below and beyond the honeycomb tile, the solidity of the world recedes. I am safe for as long as this strange vision holds. Later, ego death, the twirling of the leaf, and the sudden separation of the greens. Doors of perception remain open for the duration. I cannot prove that either of us is here, or that any of this is real. Certain that I can't tell you what any of it means. But I know that my love created you, because I was there at the moment that you slipped screaming into this world. So in my workshop at Multnomah Art Center, which is a fantastic place here in Portland, we did an exercise with photographs, and this is a poem that came out of one of the photographs that was passed to me. Valerie's family photo totally destroys me, for Angelo Luna. Somewhere in the recesses of my memory resides the perpetual joy of watching your hair bounce as you ran from me, your little legs infused with boundless energy, your little head barely containing a consciousness bursting with limitless possibility. Like lone wolf and cub, we traversed the strange and passive-aggressive streets of Ghost Town, and I wrote down every word you said because they were brilliant. You reminded me that magic is real, that life is good, that despite your mother's concerted effort to destroy me, everything would eventually be okay. You saved my ass. You do not even realize that our adventures could have ended with the shadow of a horrible memory, a newspaper clipping reporting the violent end of a father who simply gave up. Thank you for every smile, every kiss, every time you challenged me or made me laugh. Your love makes every sacrifice worthwhile. You're not a little boy anymore, except in my heart's memory, and I can never thank you properly for bringing me back to life. In this next poem is a poem that I have never read to the person that it is for. This is a poem for a friend who lost a child that she was carrying. Rose never to be unfurled. No words, no consolation, no imagining. An end to the memory, the ache from the one who grew inside. Almost was, but never was, to be. No words, no way to alleviate the grief, no way to heal the heart of a mother whose child never came to breathe. And then I've been as angry as I think everyone has been about our, turn toward fascism here in America. So far, I've not been able to write a whole lot about it, but I did write this poem. I think it turned out pretty well. I turned it into a broadside, and it's appearing in a few different places. So I guess other people are finding some meaning in this, but this is all I've been able to say so far. Now you know. The morning after the end finally began, there were tears and panic and protests and proclamations. A new fear spread among us like a virus. Some hid, some posted, some trolled, while others took to the streets. It felt as if the sunshine had been unceremoniously snuffed out, and we were cast into a new nightmare, the pall of which hung over every interaction like a thundercloud, like a swift kick to the hope. Much of what had once felt crucial was rendered suddenly trivial when faced with the prospect of internment, deportation, civil war, racial hatred, misogyny, and bloodshed. Now you know how the Germans let it go down. What to do now? Speak. Love. Fight. And this is one of, I've been writing these poems that I call collage poems because they're basically arranging lines from other places, although they're not all from poems. They can come from anywhere. This is called Always Naked, a Constellation Prize, and some of the people who I borrowed from here, Patti Smith, our friend Tiffany Burba, Nick Cave, John Irving, Wendell Pierce, they're all in here somewhere. Always Naked, a Constellation Prize. We all have this channeling, this shamanistic ability. Some make more use of it than others. Every once in a while, my own genius overwhelms me. I got secrets, cousin, constellations being lit by the subject matter. When you see them with space between them, they are phenomenal specks of light. But so many things become less certain, somewhat conundrous. We don't have any answers to these questions, and we don't want them. We don't need them. We just need to do the work. You've got to understand your limitations. It's your limitations that make you the wonderful disaster you most probably are. You don't choose what you fear. It chooses you. You have to have hubris in this world. There are people who will try to strip you of your humanity. There are those who don't have your best interests at heart. Be fine. I know you will. So the challenge with those is to use this, you know, found material to say things that I would like to say. And so if it's working, it sounds like me somehow. This is, there are so many poems about Tony, and many of them I do not have permission to share with the world. But this is a short one about Tony that I thought I would share. The good things in life are better than any damn movie. The search for love is a pink herring, a desire to possess or become a character in a Hollywood romance, never bothering to see or get to know your leading lady. A game that necessarily renders both of you meaningless, formless shadows flickering on the wall. The only way to avoid this unhappy ending is to refuse to play the game at all. Be exactly who you are. Open your heart, and eventually your little queenie will walk through that door. One of her many nicknames. And there is a rock and roll theme emerging. So this is my dedication to Chuck Berry, who is the actual king of rock and roll, and I think you'll get it when I read it.
Oh, yeah.
King of what? King of who? There is nothing regal about the way Elvis would go cross-eyed every time he did something cute in one of his movies. Nothing rocking about the minstrel show spoon-fed to young white girls to protect them from Chuck Berry, Muddy Waters, and Little Richard. And if he truly loved the music he aped, watered down, and emasculated, that pained look of embarrassment he wears on screen must reflect his awareness that he would forever remain second rate, a pale imitation. That's my version of the, you know, the Public Enemy thing about Elvis. This is called How to Shape the Poetry Juice That's All Around You. And this is another one that borrows from a lot of people. And I think, yeah, Toni is in here. She's the title partly came from her. How to Shape the Poetry Juice That's All Around You. Beauty and pretty are never in the same room. One man's wail is another's lullaby. Free from the curse of language, finally happy. Pleasure and joy can be a weapon. Like broccoli, it will do you no harm. Like violence is what we do. It's all good, know what I mean? Put the pieces where you may. Let the mask fall, or put it on. The page will hold you. Howl, but don't get cocky, and you will shine like the brightest bling. Contemplation of all that must be left behind, the advantage of asceticism, desire to shrink and expand simultaneously, to stave off this need to lick everything. Nothing noble about being a consumer of souls. Loudness, come to rock and shock you. To be large, big in Japan without totally destroying Osaka. Learn to take nothing personally while personalizing everything. Always a third way, at least. Return to the well, throw yourself in. Swim in the eddy of words rather than the landfill of perpetual baked goods. Only you can set yourself free. Take a leap into the void, into a river of revision. Delicious. A very beautiful place to live.
Revision. I like thinking of it that way. Okay, you too have about a minute left
about
or so.
Left.
So
okay.
If you've got a teeny one or a section.
I think I can do that. Okay. If I have a minute left, I will do this one. This is one of those ones that kind of percolated for a long time, something that I really needed to say. And when it came out, I was pretty happy with it.
Right.
The title comes from Jack Spicer. All beauty is at continuous war with God. One. It's short. One, you've got it all wrong. Whatever it is cannot be labeled, cornered, captured, or caged. Its power comes from the mystery. Beauty, the direct result of its ineffability. Not knowing is the secret. Not needing to know is the key. Realize that the answer is unattainable and ought to remain that way. You defile the very possibility of revelation when you try to place it in a box, erect palaces, build altars, put it on display for all the world to see. The glory in captivity. Two, not knowing can be painful, but it feels more honest. Rather be in the dark with hope than standing in the light, nothing left to learn. My disappointment is boundless. Your pretty words would be easier to swallow were they not so often followed by the gleeful slitting of your brother's throat. What, I ask, has any of this to do with love?
Mm. Well, thank you, too. Thank you, too, T-O-O, and thank you, too, T-W-O. What a treat. What a treat. All right. Well, I have, as I do on this show, questions and considerations for the two of you and me a little. We'll see. I have a couple that are specific to each of you. Chris, one of the things I want to ask you, and I'm going to ask you, is just if you would say a few words, as we say in the media, about your thoughts about poetry's relationship to music. Because I know you do a lot of gigs with musicians, and of course, your own work is often very lyrical, and you have a lot of knowledge, hence the Elvis poem, about the history of classic American music. So I thought, well, a lot of people talk about the relationship between poetry and music. If you've got some words for us, let's hear them.
Yeah, well, poetry is part of an oral tradition. Music has always been connected to it. So I think that for each poet, we have to do our own version of ear training. And a good poem exists on the page as well as in the air. And so for me, you know, listening to John Coltrane, you know, listening to James Brown, you know, those, all of those places where music has moved me in some way have helped me to be a better poet. And certainly working with musicians has helped me to find the rhythm that was already there in my own pieces and let that come alive and breathe and have a little more space to live. And so, you know, I think it's essential for poets to engage with music however they decide to do that. It just helps us to do our job, I think, you know.
Okay, thank you. Tony, I've got a specific one for you as well, because
sure.
I was thinking about your work in the visual arts. Similarly, some thoughts about the relationship between collage and poetry in your own work, in the world, however you want to think about that.
Sure. Well, I think, first of all, I think my poetry emerged from my social work, my work with people, in a variety of different with a variety of different populations along the way. The visual art sort of emerged as a way to give something that you can see in the same way that you might read my poem on the page, or you might hear me read it. My visual art frequently represents something. Again, like social commentary. It sort of manifests in that way. Mm-hmm. So if it's something I might not have written about or something I can't write about, maybe I can create something that you can look at that tells you in a similar way the same story.
It's interesting to use the visual to, quote-unquote, make a statement.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. That's,
I see what you're saying, or mm-hmm. I hear what you're saying, mm-hmm. or whatever that phrase is. Well, thank you. Okay, I wanted to, before I just throw it open and you'll both answer the rest of these questions, I thought, well, there are these two specific things that these two people do. So, okay, here's a question for both or either of you. What are some differences in the experience when you're making poems or other art, and you both, of course, make stuff in other arts, between working alone, as you both do individually, and working as a team, the pair of people? Because I think of you in both ways, and I know that you have a certain amount of presence, and I mean that in the most positive sense, in the poetry community on both sides of the river here in the Vancouver-Portland area. And it's about both of those ways of being, the individual and the working together. So in your thoughts, in your experience, however you want to address it, what are some differences for each and both of you between the thing of, okay, here's Tony, she's making her art, whether it's word art or visual. Here's Chris, he's making his art. Or here's Tony and Chris and Tony, and they're doing something. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So
sure.
What do
sure.
you got?
Well, I'll start by saying that most of what we've done in terms of poetry, we've collaborated on projects that we bring to the community, or that we're bringing to Poets in the Schools, or to our work on Printed Matter Vancouver, that we're collaborating where it's more project-driven. We have also performed two-voice poems, mostly, I believe I wrote both of them, but then we performed them together. On the visual art, interestingly, we collaborated on our first piece a couple of months ago. You would have, maybe that should have happened years ago, but we really were working on something for a group show at Angst Gallery for submitting, and I had an idea, and he had an idea, and we said, well, why don't we, let's put that together and see what we come up with. And actually, we both liked it. So, so I think we both sort of bring our own set of strengths. Our styles are very different. Very clearly, Chris has his energy is probably more prominent, more direct, sort of more out there. I'm more reserved. My sort of introverted self kind of lurks in the background and then comes forward. So we sort of bring that to the projects, which is a nice balance for us, I think.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think because I'm sitting next to my wife, I want to, like, talk about, you know, how I feel about this personally. I mean, I suffered in my past from being with people who did not either understand or respect the fact that I'm a poet. I mean, for me, what I do is who I am. There's no separation between the art and the life at all, and I don't want there to be. So it was great when Tony came into my life because I didn't have to translate and because I didn't have to justify my existence. If I needed to go into my office to work on a poem for a couple of hours, she knew that it didn't mean that I was suddenly hated her guts or something. She understood what I was doing because she might be trying to do the same thing at the same time. So that's really wonderful. And what she said about our styles being different, I think has turned out to be a strength because we have a mutual respect, which is something that's important in this kind of a situation. But the fact that we're not doing exactly the same thing with our work means that there's a lot less of a possibility that ego can come into it. I mean, I think that one of the things I got from collaborating with the musicians and different people that I've collaborated with over the years is that it forces you to kind of set that aside. All of us as visual artists and writers are used to having complete control over whatever we're doing. And there's something really wonderful about allowing that openness of hearing what of hearing what someone else has to say and then allowing them to contribute and then seeing this beautiful new third thing that's created that wouldn't have been possible if each of you had tried to do something as individuals. And I find that when I work on stuff with Tony and also when I work with these musicians I've been lucky enough to work with, is that it's like we're making this third thing that's it's a hybrid, and it's not, neither one of us could make it alone.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. That's just what I was thinking. Would it be impossible for any individual of the pair or in a group to do what the collaborative team has done? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, here's another sort of related question. Are there times that your community-focused work and your personal work sort of meld, you know, come together? I'm assuming that that must happen, but of course I'm not doing it, so I could be totally off base. And if it does happen, how does that go? And here's a little add-on. Can there even be projects of the two kinds that do not affect or touch each other? I guess it's related to this last thing you were just saying, Chris. I mean, stuff happens once you allow the process to begin, but it seems to me that even though I haven't done the kind of community work y'all are doing, that there are, you start with a difference rather than writing about something from memory or a personal relationship. You're thinking about, well, how will this go in the city? How will this work in the region? You know, whatever the project is, that's quite a different starting place. But then is there a coming together? Is there a clash? Or is this question of no use and we can go on to the next? I mean, I'm totally open
to
whatever.
It's really a matter of context, you know. At Ghost Town Poetry Open Mic, it's anything goes, and that's how it was designed or what I wanted it to be. It's kind of been an experiment in anarchy for 13 years. When you do something like the poems on the buses, we had to decide, and it wasn't just the two of us, others were involved when we were judging the poems in the contest, you know, what we didn't want people to be riding the bus and look up and then suddenly discover the reason why they should end it all. You know what I mean? We wanted to make sure that the poems that we chose were things that if you were on a hard commute or you'd had a bad day, that it would inspire you in some way and make you, certainly it could make you think about something, but we didn't want it to bring people down. So to me, the context is everything in terms of what you're asking about. Is there's many different ways to serve the community and to give the community a voice, and how much you get involved in tempering that depends on the project, I guess. Do you want to add anything?
Well,
to that?
One example. We both feel as personally invested because of our own journey and our own, you know, own process, and invested from a community aspect in helping writers who are just sort of beginning their process with poetry. That whatever we can do, whatever connections we can help them make, to help them sort of launch themselves into the world. And it's important after people have had an opportunity to read their work for the first time, to read it for the first time publicly, to think about how to get more of their work out into the world. So the project that we had thought, well, wouldn't it be great if we did an anthology? Well, what would an anthology look like, and who should be in the anthology? Well, certainly we want to have some of our featured readers from Ghost Town. But what's even more important is some of our beginning writers. And so it was a project that allowed us to sort of meld together where the outreach was larger, the larger community, people who had been published, people from, you know, all over who were our featured readers, and people who probably, some of them, never considered submitting something, maybe never thought that they would be in print, in a book, in an anthology. And so to be able to pull that off and sort of the nuances of putting all of that together. So that's sort of where those two sides of what you were saying really came together for us, our belief that people deserve this opportunity if they want it, and how can we facilitate that?
Yeah. And encourage that, obviously.
And encourage it, absolutely,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. If they didn't think of it, you say, well, did you ever think of this? That
exactly.
kind of thing.
Exactly.
Know? Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then to see the result, because then after they were in an anthology, some of them just took off, like you can't believe. Started submitting their work, read more around town, went to more open mics, that kind of thing. So when you see sort of the fruits of what a little bit of encouragement can do, it's absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's good news.
Mm-hmm.
Good news. I'm scanning my potential question list to decide, because now I'm the one who's thinking, let's see how many minutes we got left. let's just do at least a couple minutes on the fact that here we are in the Pacific Northwest. Uh-huh. And we got this big river that runs between Portland and Vancouver. But basically, geographically speaking, this is our region, uh-huh. Vancouver and Portland. And when I was thinking about the fact that you folks were coming into town and that you don't live here and I live here, I thought, well, what if we were in Oakland, or what if we were in Omaha, or what if we were in Augusta, Maine? Would we be different in our lives in relation to poetry in any way that we can think of right now off the top of our heads, tops of our heads, because of our geography, because of the mm-hmm. territory, because of where we are in terms of actually the ground, you know, the mountains, the trees, etc., or the fact that we're in the upper left corner of the United States of America, or, you know, anything like that, mm-hmm. anywhere you want to go with this, if indeed you want to go anywhere with this question. What do you think? In terms of location, 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 location.
Sure.
Heaven help me, I sound like a realtor. Anyway.
Well, when I first, I'm, you know, resolutely a New Yorker. A New Yorker is just a person who thinks that who compares everything disfavorably to New York forever, no matter where they might find themselves.
Uh-oh.
But since I got here and I got to the region in 2001 and got to Vancouver in 2003, the poets of this region have put me on the radio, give me a place to read my stuff, published my work. You know, they just embraced me right away, even before I had a title in front of my name, even before anyone knew who I was. And that's a real strength here. And I would say maybe in some of the more densely populated urban areas of America, including New York, maybe it's harder for a poet to distinguish mm-hmm. himself or herself. I mean, there are a lot of poets in the Pacific Northwest, but even in the different parts of the Northwest that I've visited, it does feel like in those pockets, people they're kind of looking out for each other, they're supporting each other's work, they're helping each other mm-hmm. to find those opportunities. And I'm not sure it's as easy as that in other places. I'm uh-huh. not sure if that has anything at all to do with our, you know, geological context, but that's been my experience. It's like uh-huh. from here all the way up. I mean, it's a good place to be a writer. It's a place mm-hmm. where you can find yourself or find support for what you're doing, find a way to get your work out into the world.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Well, I think there are obviously a lot of opportunities to connect with other poets. There are a lot of readings. People are launching their books. There are major sort of festivals, and there are many opportunities. And one then has the challenge of sort of plugging themselves in. I mean, we always, it's kind of maybe a running joke for us. We're like, we could go to something related to poetry every single night of the week for the entire month. Right? And obviously you can't, because because
you have a life.
Nobody does that.
But nobody can do that. Yeah. And
how we love poetry, but
we love it, but you also, how do you balance everything else, right? But here are all of these opportunities. You know, here sort of the challenge is going back and forth over the river, and we do have people from Portland that come over
including Judith and Patrick.
Exactly. And we encourage people from Vancouver to come over to Portland. Get yourself out there. The only way that you can connect really with people you don't know in the poetry world is to go to these readings. Mm-hmm. And yes, there are some barriers. Traffic is a barrier, but you can overcome those things and just work it out and make those connections.
We need a resurgence of ferry boats.
Yeah, we need something.
You know, bridges are good, and we've got some great bridges.
I know.
But a boat, or a couple of boats, located maybe between mm-hmm. I-5 and 205, two or three ferry landings. That would be very cool and fun to boot.
Yeah, one of my good poet friends is Raul Sanchez, who lives up by Seattle, and we met on a boat going over to Whidbey Island when there was a yearly festival uh-huh. on Whidbey Island. And by the time we got across the water, we were friends for life. I mean, a boat is as good a place as any to you know, meet your
I love that.
Poetic
friends.
I think
friends, you need to pitch that, Judith.
A perfect example. No, we'll
and
use
And you have enough time
Chris's
to do
example.
A poetry reading on most, you know, on ferry
a boat.
Rides.
Yeah, sure. Even yeah. even if you're going to one of the closest ones from Seattle, mm-hmm. what, Bainbridge, you could do a poetry reading on that boat.
Absolutely.
Easy. Okay, let's get on this, people.
Okay.
In our, as I love to say, quoting everyone in the world, in our spare time, whatever that may be. Okay. All right, here's a different kind of question. Are there poems or poets or what I think of sometimes as poetry moments, experiences with poetry that have been notable, important, useful for you?
Wow.
Just a short, I mean, I know there are thousands, so I'm saying just pick one. Or one that you feel like you'd like to put on the radio. And, I mean, well, Chris, you talked about just meeting this other poet on the boat. But specifically in response to this question, then, want to tell us?
You go first.
She's pointing at me. So,
yeah.
So in 94, before I was a student at the Kerouac School, you could go out as a citizen and basically do everything except for the workshops. So they had a week-long tribute to Allen Ginsberg, and this is while he was still alive. Mm. Allen Ginsberg is the reason that I'm a poet. And so I got to go out and spend the week with Ferlinghetti and Diane de Prima and Amiri Baraka, and the list goes on. All of those folks were there to celebrate Allen, and Allen was there. And there was a tall, skinny, big bearded poet who I did not recognize sitting on the grass with people around him. He obviously had minions or friends, people who admired him, and I didn't recognize him. He wasn't one of the people on the list of, you know. And he turned out to be a poet from Wisconsin named Antler, who was one of the many sort of people who Allen took under his wing and tried to help get published and things like that. And on the last day of this incredible experience that would have changed my life whether or not I went back to Naropa as a student, Antler came up to me and gave me a big hug, and he looked me in the eyes and he said, "Make poetry your life." And I don't know if anyone has ever done anything like that to you, but I was, I don't know, 23 or so, something like that. I took it very seriously, and that's pretty much like what I've been doing since then. And I mean, after a week of spending time with those kinds of people and hearing their ideas and hearing their wonderful work and really just being able to have regular conversations with these huge figures, you know, that's exactly what I wanted to do, and that's what I've been doing since, I guess. You know?
And then this guy came up and basically pierced your eyes with his eyes and said that astonishing thing to you. That ain't an everyday experience.
Well, he went back to Wisconsin, and we corresponded, and I mean, at these kinds of things, you never know who you're going to meet. Dave Dellinger was there, and of course, I knew who Dave Dellinger was, but I didn't know what he looked like, so I was trying to figure out why people are being reverent toward this guy. And when I got to know him, he was a great guy, and we corresponded for a few years about the Leonard Peltier case. That's what he was really working on the last few years of his life. But I mean, the fact that you could sit on the grass and talk to Dave Dellinger or have a conversation with him at a, you know, a cocktail party or whatever is one of the things that makes that a real jewel there in Boulder, Colorado, you know.
Yeah. You want to give us one, Tony?
Well,
or?
Quickly, I read Dorianne Locke's, I read her poem. She was pivotal in me reengaging with poetry. Mm. Many years later, I took a master class from her, and it was fascinating. At the same time, her husband, Joseph Millar, is a writer. He writes poetry that's very blue-collar. And I really relate to that. That's sort of my family roots, and he is inspiring to me. But in the interim between being a kid and writing, and then seeing Dorianne when I was working at Mount Hood Community College, I was in college and took a poetry class, and was introduced to Charles Bukowski. And I had been looking for a way to be able to say the things I wanted to say that were quite irreverent and questioning and probably rebellious, and hadn't really found a way sort of to say those things so clearly. And after I read Bukowski, I found a path.
I'll bet you did.
Yes, I did.
Yes. Well, that, you know, those are two. I'm so glad I chose that question from my little typed page here, because those are such extraordinary examples of just the kind of thing, you know, who gets lucky? Well, you two got lucky. And Thank you. Those are terrific examples.
Well, and both of those stories remind us that poets need to go outside. That's probably the thing that I say to my students right now more than anything is we're all looking at screens all the time. Even if you take a walk to the end of your block, you will find the poem there. You know, I mean, but get away from the screens if you can. You
know? Yeah, yeah. Go outside.
Go outside. Go anywhere.
A good admonition in many circumstances and contexts, but certainly this one, yes. Well, all right. I believe we have come to just about the end of this evening's show. Thanking you again for coming over the river and joining us. And I want to tell y'all out there in Radioland that next month's Poetry and Everything will be on the air on May 22nd. That will be the fourth Monday then. So tune in then for more of Poetry and Everything, or listen anytime, anywhere on the webnet, or perhaps you'd like to say net web, because all of our shows will be there within, several hours after you hear them on the radio. They're on the webnet for, as I like to say, as long as the webnet lasts. So, thank you for listening, folks. Support your local independent bookstores, your independent reading series, and independent radio. Good night.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good evening. This program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Hawthorne Veterinary Clinic, striving to promote health and well-being of your animal companions by blending conventional and alternative medicine. Hawthorne Vet is located at 1431 Southeast 23rd, just north of Hawthorne, in Portland. Information is at 503-233-2332 and hawthornvet.com. This is the Sudden Radio Project. You're listening to KBOO, Portland.